routine public health measures could take care of it. So a little premature to talk about booster shots.
Well, Dr. Ali Khan, we want to thank you so much for being with us, epidemiologist and dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, former director of the CDC's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response, author of The Next Pandemic on the Front Lines Against Humankind's Gravest Dangers. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon and Washington face an extreme heat watch this weekend. Oregon closes in on its vaccination goal with a final round of county risk assessments, and the Supreme Court rules against expanding police power on warrantless searches. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Much of Oregon and Washington will be on an extreme heat watch starting Friday. The Pacific Northwest will be seeing record-breaking heat, about 20 to 25 degrees higher than average June temperatures. The National Weather Service warns that people should be careful with how much they exert themselves outside over the weekend. Overnight, we won't see much relief either, with temperatures hovering in the mid-70s. Parts of eastern Oregon could reach high temps of 111 degrees. In the Portland-Vancouver area and in the Gorge, the National Weather Service says highs up to 108 degrees are possible. The Coast Range and southern Oregon also risk triple digits. This comes as a lot of the western United States is in a historic drought, the worst in 20 years. Our region experienced exceptionally low rainfall and snowfall last year, which contributes to the drought and the water shortages. In Portland, pools and splash pads have reopened in time for the heat wave. Interested swimmers need to reserve an hour slot online with the specific type of swimming that they intend on doing. Sprinklers and fountains around the city are not as restricted. They only require social distancing and general outdoor coronavirus guidance. Portland police won't be stopping drivers for low-level traffic violations like expired plates and broken headlights. It's a new policy that Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Police Chief Chuck Lavelle announced yesterday. Cops can make the stop for those minor violations only if it's related to an immediate safety threat. Another major change to policy is that cops now need to get consent on the record in order to search someone's car. They also have to make it clear that the person has the right to refuse to have their car searched. The changes were prompted by the discrimination that black drivers face in the city for minor traffic violations. Only 6% of Portlanders are black, but they make up 18% of the total traffic stops in the city. Other cities have adopted similar policies as well, like in Oakland, California. cops will still be making judgment calls out in the field. Chief Lavelle clarified at a press conference that, for example, if a car was driving at night without lights, they might still get pulled over since it would be considered an immediate safety issue. Addressing the inequity in traffic stops is one part of the motivation for the change, but another is that the police bureau says it's stretched pretty thin. Over the past year, 125 officers have left the bureau, according to COIN. The change is being hailed as a strong step towards racial justice in policing. Wheeler said of the data driving the decision, quote, "It's part of a clear pattern in recent years that has certainly been highlighted by the racial justice movement we're experiencing now, and it's a pattern that will continue unless we do something about it." The Multnomah County Sheriff's Department will be reining in its use of the crowd control unit at protests, according to one top union official. Sergeant Matt Ferguson says that the commitment to reel in their efforts was informal, but it's related to the mass resignation of the Portland Police's rapid response team. 50 members of that team resigned after one of their own, Officer Corey Budworth, was charged with fourth-degree assault for beating a photojournalist over the head with a baton at a protest. Sergeant Ferguson said, quote, "We're probably going to greatly restrict our activities. I don't think it's in our members' best interests to go clear rioters from the streets." Already, the sheriff's departments in Washington and Clackamas counties have distanced themselves from participating in crowd control and protest response in Portland. Police unions at the city and the county level have expressed disagreement with Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt. Schmidt was elected on a platform of racial justice and has not been so quick to prosecute demonstrators for minor offenses. Plus, just last week, he indicted Budworth for misdemeanor assault, and his office is still looking at other instances of force. In 2020, cops responding to protests in Portland reported at least 6,000 use of force incidents. The impact of the decision from the Sheriff's Department is that, for the time being, police response to protests in Portland won't be done by officers who've had special training. The Supreme Court ruled that police can't enter a house without a warrant when pursuing someone for a minor crime. The court case was about a California man who was chased by police into his garage for allegedly playing loud music while driving down a deserted highway late at night. The court ruled unanimously. The cop had no right to enter the man's house without a warrant for such a trivial offense. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution bans unreasonable searches, which is why police need a warrant to enter somebody's home. The Supreme Court has said for a long time that cops can pursue a suspected felon and conduct a warrantless search, but in this case they decided that if the suspected crime is minor, like a noise violation, they can't do it. Civil liberties groups were concerned about the outcome of this case because if the ruling went the other way, it could have vastly expanded police powers since a lot of crimes are at the misdemeanor level. But police power was in fact restricted in this case. Cops can't do a warrantless search of someone suspected of a misdemeanor even when they're in quote-unquote hot pursuit. Oregon is ever so close to reaching its 70% vaccination goal, with 68.8% of the eligible population vaccinated against coronavirus so far. Governor Brown announced the final Oregon County risk level changes. Polk County met their 65% vaccination benchmark and got moved into the lower risk level. Klamath, Jefferson, and Marion counties will be moved from high to moderate risk. Now there's 23 counties at low risk, 7 at moderate risk, and 6 in high risk. The state is around 40,000 people short of the 70% vaccination goal, but it's unclear when it can be reached since vaccination rates have slowed greatly. The CDC said that on Monday the 21st, only 1,082 people got their first shot. Even if the pace were to pick up, it's unlikely that Oregon could hit the 70% mark by the 4th of July. That's prompted some to call for the governor to drop the restrictions sooner, instead of when the state passes the benchmark, as she has previously promised. Jason Brandt is the president of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. He told KGW that the governor should reopen the economy on June 30th. He said, quote, "At this point, based on how we're seeing vaccinations pace down, a June 30 date in stone that everyone can rely on, that everyone can plan for, would be the best thing we could do to get our small businesses back on track." Others see it as an important milestone to reach, and the governor has not made any indications that she will change her plans. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 267 new cases of COVID-19 and one new death. That new case count is slightly higher than the 7-day average in Oregon. Inverness Jail in Northeast Portland is reporting an outbreak of coronavirus. At least 25 inmates have tested positive for the virus. The sheriff's office spokesperson said the outbreak started on May 23rd. This is not the first outbreak at the jail. In April, 15 inmates at Inverness sued Multnomah County and the sheriff, saying that the county failed to take proper precautions, that they denied inmates testing and mixed infected inmates and guards with the general healthy population. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have blocked a sweeping voting rights bill that would have updated protections from discriminatory voting rules. Surprisingly, centrist Democrat Joe Manchin voted with his party, despite saying earlier that he didn't approve of the bill. Nadia Ramlagan has that story and more with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I can't think of anything more important, anything more fundamental to our democracy than the freedom to vote.
Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow tried to convince her GOP colleagues to support a sweeping bill to overhaul federal elections, but Senate Republicans blocked it, ratcheting up already inflamed tensions over voting rights. Senators in the evenly divided body voted 50-50 on advancing the For the People Act, splitting along party lines and failing to get the 60 votes needed to overcome a GOP filibuster. The vote was the culmination of weeks of partisan rancor and behind-the-scenes talks over changing the nation's voting laws in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. Even as COVID-19 vaccines bring hope, experts are sounding the alarm on the pandemic's unprecedented toll on mental health. New York Republican Congressman John Katko says 25% of kids nationwide have had suicidal ideations since the pandemic began.
They didn't even have an inpatient unit for pediatric mental health in Syracuse. And parents had to drive sometimes 2 hours away just to get their kids' mental health treatment.
The White House COVID-19 response team says the U.S. will miss its July 4th goal of 70% of adults vaccinated. COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients says the White House is now focused on vaccinating 18 to 26-year-olds.
Now, everyone involved in this effort knows, and the president has said repeatedly, our work does not stop on July 4th. Or at 70%. But we use this aspirational goal to drive progress in a very short period of time. It's taken a huge collective effort, and we have made significant progress.
The dangerous Delta variant of the coronavirus is spreading so quickly in the United States that it's likely the mutant strain will become predominant in the nation within weeks, according to federal health officials and a new analysis. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health has announced more than 20% of new cases are due to the Delta variant. The opioid epidemic also has picked up speed. Data from the CDC show overdose deaths increased in almost every state during the first 8 months of 2020. 24 states and the District of Columbia had an estimated increase of at least 30%. The Supreme Court has ruled unanimously against the National Collegiate Athletic Association in a dispute over limits placed on certain compensation that student athletes can receive. Former NBA player Rex Chapman on the decision written by Justice Neil Gorsuch.
What the NCAA has been doing has just been so flatly wrong. He felt strong enough to write an opinion and basically say, you know, anywhere in the world, what the NCAA has been doing, their business model would be flatly illegal.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan. Thanks for listening.
A report out this week that examines data on child well-being in 2019 puts Oregon in the middle of the pack. And that was before the pandemic, which has exacerbated many of the issues that Oregon kids face. Eric Tegedoff has more on what the data finds and where Oregon can improve.
Child well-being in Oregon was a mixed bag before the pandemic, according to a new report. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count data looks at indicators in economics, education, health, and community from 2019. It ranks Oregon in the middle, at 25 overall. Jennifer Wagley, head of Our Children Oregon, says the state should celebrate policy wins like its effort to cover kids with health insurance. She says this also shows that Oregon can make other policy decisions that work for children.
We know that Oregon can be better than middle of the pack, and that's what we're fighting for. We think that Oregon should be a place where every child thrives and can achieve their full potential, and we know the investments that are needed to make that possible.
Oregon still lags in education, ranking 40th. Wagley says the state is improving when it comes to students graduating on time, but still is in the bottom five of states. She also notes that investments will be important as the state recovers from the pandemic, and that policymakers need to make sure the recovery isn't uneven for communities of color. Leslie Bossier with the Casey Foundation says Congress passed pandemic relief quickly, including a year-long expansion of the child tax credit within the American Rescue Plan Act. She says permanently expanding the tax credit would deliver the financial support families need and reduce long-standing disparities affecting millions of families of color.
Expected to raise as many as half of children who are currently living below the poverty line to living above the poverty line.
Wagley says the country should make the child tax credit from the last recovery bill permanent, noting the policy drastically reduces child poverty. She says the pandemic provides an opportunity to make the lives of families better.
We don't want to go back to the way it was because it wasn't okay for most families then. And so now we want to reimagine and rebuild toward an equitable future where all children have what they need to thrive.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Rose City Book Pub owner Elise Schumach on her revoked federal grant from the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Then at 5:45, it's Noise Filter debunking COVID-19. At 6, stick around for the Underground. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with some clouds and a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 86. Today in history, in 1961, the Antarctic Treaty System comes into force. It set aside Antarctica as a scientific preserve and limited military activity on the continent, its islands, and ice shelves. The quote of the day is from Ernest Shackleton, who was a part of the first three British expeditions to the Antarctic. He said, quote, "I chose life over death for myself and my friends. I believe it is in our nature to explore, to reach out into the unknown. The only true failure would be to not explore at all." John McAfee, the founder of the antivirus software of the same name, was found dead in a Spanish prison today. He was 75. McAfee was in jail in Spain because he hadn't filed tax returns in the United States from 2014 to 2018, even as it was obvious he was making lots of money from promoting cryptocurrency and selling his life story for a documentary, among other things. He was also indicted in the U.S. in March for falsely promoting cryptocurrencies to unwitting investors, for a profit of at least $13 million. McAfee claimed he would face political persecution if he was sent back to the United States to face trial, but the Spanish court rejected that assertion and said it would send him back to the U.S. According to local authorities, the cause of death is likely suicide. McAfee has faced legal scrutiny in the past, once related to the death of one of his neighbors in Belize. He ended up fleeing his home there after police named him as a person of interest. The antivirus software company hasn't been affiliated with John McAfee himself for some time since he resigned in 1994. Over the past few weeks, there have been disturbing revelations of hundreds of remains of Native children who were killed while forced to attend residential schools. One Native advocate is relieved that the federal government is finally acknowledging the violent history of Indian boarding schools. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A former Indian boarding school student and advocate is welcoming a federal initiative to investigate and bring to light the troubled legacy of Indian boarding schools in the United States.
Well, it's kind of like a sigh of relief. There's some recognition at the federal level that something needs to get started.
Jim LaBelle is involved in sharing boarding school stories of Alaska Native students and is a member of the National Native Boarding School Coalition. He says Tuesday's announcement launching the initiative by Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland was a godsend.
There's been so many of us that have been advocating for some sort of recognition of the boarding school era, and also been fighting for some sort of truth and reconciliation. But more importantly, how can we come together and use this experience to heal and forward?
LaBelle attended federal institutes in Southeast Alaska for 10 years, starting at age 8 in 1955. He says the early years were traumatic, and the impacts of boarding schools have caused intergenerational trauma in Native communities.
We pass down our own traumas to our own descendants, to our children and grandchildren, who pass it on to theirs. We seem to have the same cycle of self-harm and abuse.
LaBelle says he has worked to understand what happened to him, deal with anger, shame, and forgiveness for oppressors and himself. He'd like to see trauma addressed in Holland's initiative. Holland announced a comprehensive review of federal boarding school policies in her remarks to the National Congress of American Indians virtual mid-year conference.
I know that this process will be long and difficult. I know that this process will be painful. It won't undo the heartbreak and loss that so many of us feel. But only by acknowledging the past can we work toward a future that we're all proud to embrace.
Beginning in the 1800s, laws and policies established Indian boarding schools across the country to assimilate children, taking them away from their communities. Holland's initiative will investigate boarding school facilities, locate burial sites, and identify students. It follows the discovery last month of the remains of 215 students at a residential school in Canada. The Little Shell Tribe in Montana and two other tribes have settled a case decades in the making to compensate descendants for the taking of land by the U.S. government. Taylor Stagner with Yellowstone Public Radio and A Report for America has more.
The Little Shell, Chippewa, and Chippewa Cree, along with the White Earth Tribe of Minnesota and the Turtle Mountain Tribe of North Dakota, will split a $59 million settlement. Gerald Gray is the chairman of the Little Shell Chippewa. He says that the settlement doesn't come close to covering the amount of energy revenue lost by the tribes.
You probably get that in an hour. So we ceded quite a bit of land to the U.S. government for pennies, not even dollars.
Chairman Gray also says that not every tribal member will receive a slice of the pie.
It's only those who received money before.
This is the third and final settlement case for the descendants of the Pembina Chippewa who were taken advantage of by the U.S. government during the early 1800s. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is hosting a roundtable Wednesday on finding solutions for infrastructure development in Native communities. The committee will hear from tribal and federal witnesses about opportunities, challenges, and needs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Republican-led states are passing new legislation to restrict food assistance programs for low-income Americans. Lawmakers in states like Arkansas, Ohio, Missouri, Montana, and others are proposing extra restrictions for SNAP and WIC benefits that help low-income residents afford food. Over 20 million households in the U.S. report that they sometimes or often didn't have enough food on the table in the first week of June, according to the Census Bureau. Federal food assistance was expanded during the pandemic, and more people came to rely on it. The Biden administration and the Agricultural Department are considering expanding food assistance even after the pandemic. But Republicans say that enough has been spent on stimulus and that food assistance is keeping people from going back to work. States are passing laws to require more extensive documentation for people on food assistance, like proof of child support and documenting their savings. In Ohio, people are no longer eligible for SNAP benefits if they have over $3,000 saved or if they drive a car valued at more than $5,000. Mary Sherman has more.
The conference committee working on Ohio's budget could vote as early as today on measures that could make it more difficult to access food assistance. At the last minute, provisions were added to the Senate version of the budget aimed at reducing fraud in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Hope Lane with the Center for Community Solutions says those include asset tests that would cut off assistance for people with roughly $2,200 or more in the bank.
There's a lot of reasons that people would have that money in their account. They could be saving for tuition. They could be saving for first month, last month, and a security deposit. But if you happen to be recertifying your SNAP eligibility and you have that money in your account under this, you would not be eligible for SNAP.
The asset test would allow the first $4,650 of a vehicle to be excluded. Other provisions include requiring SNAP recipients to report every change in income and prohibiting raises in the initial eligibility for SNAP assistance. Lane argues that the changes are not needed because SNAP has one of the lowest fraud rates among public assistance programs. Lane also contends it's more red tape that can deter participation in SNAP during a time when nearly 1 in 8 Ohioans is struggling with hunger.
There are a lot of states, conservative and liberal, that have learned from the pandemic that people in their state are hungry. They were hungry before the pandemic. They are hungry after the pandemic. And instead of making it harder for people to access benefits, they have made it easier. And Ohio is just not following in the same trend.
The changes were inserted into the Senate version of the budget bill just weeks ago. They were initially part of Senate Bill 17, which faced opponent testimony earlier this year from 60 groups and individuals. This is Mary Sherman, Ohio News Connection.
The move away from gas-powered vehicles is seen as an important change in order to create climate resiliency. In Kansas, electric vehicle chargers are going up on streetlight poles. The idea is to make charging stations more accessible to everyone, including to renters. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many people who own an electric vehicle also own a home, so they can install a charger in their garage or driveway. But that's usually not an option for people who rent.
If you are a renter or an apartment dweller, you may not have access to home charging.
That's Miriam Bueleg, a project manager at the Metropolitan Energy Center, a nonprofit in Kansas City. Her group is working with the city to help overcome this barrier so more residents can switch to electric vehicles. Their plan is to add chargers to existing streetlight poles, where they're easy to see and convenient to access. With the Missouri University of Science and Technology, Bueleg's team mapped areas where chargers might be needed, like near apartment complexes, shops, and restaurants. They eliminated the sites that wouldn't work, like places where a sidewalk runs between the light pole and parking. That left them with 80 curbside locations. They plan to install up to 60 chargers in these sites by the end of the year.
Folks can park their vehicle overnight or for a few hours while they're visiting a business. So it allows for expanded access to charging for renters.
And makes it easier to drive electric. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Four players from the Portland Thorns will represent the U.S. at the Tokyo Olympics this summer. The U.S. women's national soccer team will include Thorns midfielder Crystal Dunn and Lindsay Horan, goalkeeper Adriana Franch, and defender Becky Sauerbrunn. It's the first Olympics for Franch. Dunn and Horan have been on the roster twice, and this is Sauerbrunn's third Olympics. This Olympics effort is special because the women's soccer team is vying to become the first team to win an Olympics following a World Cup title. The U.S. has won 4 gold medals in women's soccer since it became an Olympic sport in 1996. At the last Olympics in Brazil in 2016, the U.S. was knocked out on penalties in the quarterfinal by Sweden. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ken Jones, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Mary Sherman, Nadia Romlagon, Antonia Gonzalez, Emily Scott, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
As summer begins, we're slowly emerging from the isolation of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of us are returning to dine and shop indoors at restaurants and stores that were closed during the pandemic or limited to takeout and delivery. Sadly, several of those restaurants and stores took a big financial hit and had to close, while ones still open are struggling to stay in business. That's the case for our in-depth guest today, Elise Schumach, owner of Portland's Rose City Book Pub. We talked with Elise in April 2020 after she secured funding from several coronavirus relief initiatives for small businesses, including the Paycheck Protection Program, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, and the CARES Act. That funding helped keep the lights on, but the book pub still finished the fiscal year deep in the red. Elise's business was recently awarded a life-saving grant from the federal government's Restaurant Revitalization Fund, but the money was rescinded after federal judges ruled it unconstitutional to prioritize grant applicants on the basis of gender and race. Elise, thanks for joining us today during a very trying time for Rose City Book Pub and many other small businesses across the country.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Now, Elise, you opened a little background first. You opened the Rose City Book Pub in November 2018 with a very Portland idea of combining a bookstore with a pub, and you faced some big challenges right from the start. Can you give us just a little background on that, how you financed the opening and grew the business?
Yeah, so I sold my condo in Los Angeles and moved back home to Oregon. And so some of that money was my share toward getting an SBA loan. And so I sold my home and took out a pretty hefty loan, about the size of a mortgage.
And had a lot of ramping up to do as a new business owner. You were a teacher before in Southern California. So there was quite a learning curve there, but you did an amazing job. You opened the book pub, you grow a base of loyal customers in Northeast Portland and established the business as a big part of that community. Then over a year later, the pandemic hits. And of course, none of us knew how long it would last. What were your thoughts and fears at the time, say March of last year?
Yeah, that was pretty terrifying when that happened. And it was just about when my business had become well known enough that we were really happening and it was starting to turn into something pretty significant. And last year in March, before we were shut down, I had 35 events on the calendar for the month of March, readings and live music and just other sorts of community events. And then it was actually the day that the NBA shut down was when people started canceling their events and when I saw a precipitous loss of customers. And then on the 16th, they told us we were closed on the 17th. And I didn't know how long it would last, but even being closed for 2 weeks felt pretty devastating. And I knew it would be obviously longer than that. I did not think it would be this long. I don't think anyone thought it would be this long.
But you got right to work in applying for grants. We mentioned last time you were on our in-depth segment was April of last year. And you were able to get some relief through PPP, Paycheck Protection Program, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan we mentioned, and the CARES Act. I don't think you took the loan yet because that you'd be on the hook for quite a bit over the course of the business.
I took the loan because I needed it.
Oh, you did? Oh my, that was $90,000?
Yeah, so I took that loan and I've been using it. The Restaurant Revitalization Fund would have made it so that I could give that loan back. But if I didn't have that loan, I wouldn't have been able to pay bills in the meantime.
Now, how long has the book pub been open for inside dining and browsing, buying books?
My policy since the beginning has been to be open exactly as much as I'm allowed. And so I have not closed at any point in time completely, except for during the fires last year. But otherwise, we've been open every day in one way or another. So at the very beginning, it was takeout only, and then also the bookstore was open for browsing. And then slowly, the patio was allowed to be open, and then 25% capacity. So whatever that's been is what I've done.
How have you been affected financially by the pandemic? I read there was a great Oregonian article by Jamie Goldberg, which mentioned you, but it was on the program itself and other small businesses. That article mentioned that you were almost $80,000 in the red in net losses over the past year.
Yeah. So even though I got some of this relief, And some of that made up for some of these losses. It hasn't been enough except for using this loan, which I really don't want to use, because if I do have to keep that loan, I'm on the hook for $500 a month until I'm 74 years old. So last year I netted negative $78,000, and I think I got about $50,000 in grants, grants and loans. The PPP loans are forgivable if you use it toward the sorts of things they want you to use it for. And
yeah, they have a list of criteria there.
And I've been able to use it that way.
Now, this grant that was rescinded, it was a $105,000 grant, which you mentioned you could pay off your EIDL loan and keep the business going. It was set up through the U.S. Small Business Administration. And the reason for that, the objective, is to provide emergency assistance during the pandemic for restaurants, bars, and other qualifying businesses impacted by COVID-19. What was the process for applying for that and getting the grant? Was that a difficult process? You mentioned that some of those grants and loans last year, you had to jump through a lot of hoops to get.
Yeah, this one was really well executed. It was pretty smooth. And it was, honestly, maybe 10 minutes to fill out the form. And then you had to upload a couple of documents. And the main thing that they wanted to know was that you were still an active business. And so one of the things you had to upload was the last 3 months of bank statements, just to prove that you had an active business bank account. But it really was pretty straightforward questions, like social security number and where should we send the money and how much money did you lose?
And when did you get news that you got the grant?
It was the Friday before Memorial Day weekend.
Oh my, and you must have been ecstatic.
Yeah, I was so thrilled, and I took two whole days off in a row, which some people have pointed out as a weekend. Yeah. I went to Hood River and got an Airbnb with no television and terrible Wi-Fi. So I sat around and read books and drank wine and just, I was relaxed for the first time in so long.
And you had been working 7 days a week on the book pub for a long time with very little time off.
I've been taking Saturdays off, but often, I mean, anyone who's a business owner knows
right.
that a day off isn't exactly a day off.
Sometimes. You're on call.
Yeah, and there's still work to be done, and you take the opportunity to run an errand that you can't do when you're always at the bar. And yeah.
And then from those highs and the 2 days off, you know, without Wi-Fi and reading books, 2 weeks ago, a little over 2 weeks ago, you got news that the grant was rescinded. And as a business owned by a woman, the book pub apparently was prioritized for the grant, along with other businesses owned by minorities and military veterans. But the news story is white business owners in Texas and Tennessee filed a lawsuit questioning the constitutionality of how the program awarded grants. They figured that was some weird kind of discrimination, though it seems the opposite to me. I was curious, and you could tell us, and I read up on this, you know, these are two very small business owners in these states, Texas and Tennessee, but they were very well funded. Can you give us a little background on that, where they were getting the money for this long legal process?
Oh, you know, I didn't look into that. I honestly, the whole thing was so horrifying that almost all of my information about that, I've gotten secondhand because people have filled me in.
Oh, okay, because you mentioned the man behind the group that funded it, Stephen Miller.
Yeah, Stephen, yeah, and I found that out from other people. I honestly,
okay.
it was so horrifying that I couldn't pursue it. I saw what happened, and I saw Stephen Miller and Mark Meadows were associated with it, and that was enough information.
Nothing good could come out of that kind of fraternity of Mark Meadows and Stephen Miller. And they actually had a right-wing group, America First Legal, that had the money and then funded this. And there were two federal judges, both in separate regions, one for Tennessee and one for Texas, that said it was unconstitutional to prioritize on the basis of women, minorities, and even military veterans. The irony, if you can call it that, is that there would be no need for the lawsuits and federal cases if Congress had fully funded the program to begin with. And I actually read this on your Facebook page. You write that the original proposal called for $120 billion in funding. That was cut to less than $30 billion and delayed a year before passing. So it was brought up in Congress in April of 2020 and didn't pass until about a year later.
And what's notable with that is that somehow, and now Earl Blumenauer is one of the heads on that, somehow he had the presence of mind, they had the presence of mind to recognize that this was going to be a long thing. You know, I feel like an awful lot of us back in April last year were thinking, oh, one or two more months, maybe. And somehow they knew this was going to be huge. And so the idea that it got nickeled and dimed down to less than a quarter of the initial proposal, even after it had gone on and on and on. And in 15 months, think of all the restaurants that they didn't have to fund anymore because they've gone out of business. And so it's a devastating cut in what was obviously the need, and they had done the research on what the need would be.
Now, you mentioned Earl Blumenauer, and he of course represents your district in Congress, and he recently introduced legislation to add funding for the program. What are your hopes for that coming to pass? And I also wanted to ask, is there anything that we can do to support those small businesses and Representative Blumenauer's legislation?
Yeah, so the proposed increase now is $60 billion more, which would probably cover a lot of people. And the big concern I have with that is that people would try and reduce that amount again, like they did before. If that went down to a quarter like last time, $15 billion won't go very far at all. And so the hope is that it passes quickly before more of us go out of business, and then also that it passes at the full amount. And I think there's some value in writing to Earl Blumenauer, but he's already on board with this. And I think the thing I've been asking my friends to do is to contact their friends who live in Republican-based districts and ask them to write to their congressmen.
Now, the Oregonian article mentioned that the bill had some bipartisan support, which seems like that's not true. It seems like the Republican congressmen and congresswomen are trying to either delay the bill, not pass it, or reduce the funding significantly.
Yeah, the SBA told us very clearly there was a meeting for the people who had their money rescinded. They told us very clearly it's got bipartisan support. It has bipartisan support. So I think there must be at least one Republican who has backed it.
That's unfortunately the definition of bipartisan in our current Congress. Just one Republican and every Democrat. Now, what could listeners do? First let me ask before that, while you're waiting for word on the additional funding and grants, and we can all hope it goes through, there's a good chance, there's a chance at least. How are you managing to keep the book pub afloat amidst all this financial uncertainty and still some ongoing health concerns from the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, I'm just still going, and I have a few employees, but at pretty limited hours. It's me most of the time, except for when I'm running errands or taking Saturdays mostly. I've also been doing some teaching this year to make some money, so my employees have worked while I teach. So I'm just still going. Just every day I'm going to just keep working. And it has been looking up. I've been getting more business. I think my colleagues at other restaurants say that they're getting more business. And with the nice weather, it's a good time to utilize all the beautiful patios and at the restaurants in Portland. And a friend set up a GoFundMe for me.
Oh, I wanted to mention that. Yes, I saw that on the Facebook page.
Yeah, and people have been very generous. And so that's been really helpful. And then a couple of authors have donated their proceeds from their book sales for right now to me. And then we're planning a couple of fundraisers later this summer. I think we might do something with some nano breweries. We haven't worked out the details on that.
Yeah, I'm glad to see the authors stepping forward, because you're a big part of the Portland literary community, and we have one of the best in the country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There are so many great writers in Portland, and also they act as community with each other, and so it's been nice having them around a little bit more. I've missed them.
Well, Elise, thanks for sharing your story with us today. We're hoping that your business and other small businesses across the U.S., because it's really the kind of the backbone of our culture, of our economy, can secure the funding soon to make it through this very difficult time.
Yeah, I hope so. This just needs to be fully funded. That's the only way that most restaurants are going to make it. It would be impossible for me to make up these losses on my own.
We've been talking with Elise Schumach, owner of Portland's Rose City Book Pub. The book pub, located at 1329 Northeast Fremont, is currently open for business, serving up food, drinks, and of course, books. You can find out more on their website, rosecitybookpub.com, and on Facebook under Rose City Book Pub. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allendary, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allendary. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today, so let's go ahead and get started. The pandemic and our oral health. Now, the pandemic has taken a toll on our oral health. According to a survey by the American Dental Association, more dentists are seeing an increase in stress-related conditions, including teeth grinding, cracked,